Okay, so in the meantime, morning everyone. It's really a pleasure to be here for a face-to-face contest meeting. I'm really happy to be here with you in such a nice place. I will be the chairman of this first session, so I am Frédéric Laurin, a research engineer at Onera in France. And it is really a pleasure for me to be the chairman of this session, which will be performed by Jan Tolsvolf. So he is currently a tenure track research professor at KU Leuven since 2019, and his main research interest, as you will see, is micromechanical modeling, in situ computed tomography, and fiber hybridization. His contributions were recognized by the 2019 prize at the Research Council at KU Leuven and the 2020 ESCM Award. So his presentation is entitled Longitudinal Tensile Failure Model, Experimental Validation, Benchmarking, and Future Direction. So Jentel, the floor is yours.
Thank you for the introduction, Frederik, and thank you for the organizers to invite me. I'm going to talk about longitudinal tensile failure, and that's, of course, related to unidirectional composites. I'm sure all of you are aware that not all composites are unidirectional, but even when you have a multidirectional laminate, maybe you start off with off-axis cracks, with delaminations, but what eventually will control the final failure is fiber break development, which eventually leads to failure of the zero-degree plies, and that's usually the last ply to fail. We can have a long discussion during the coffee breaks which of these is the most important. I will refrain from entering that discussion, but I will focus just on how the zero-degree ply fails when it's loaded in the fiber direction. And pretty much the entire scientific community, I think, agrees on how this evolves. It starts off with the weakest fibers failing first because they don't all have the same strength. They follow a Weibull distribution. And that weakest fiber then cannot carry any load anymore, at least locally. So you get stress concentrations on the surrounding fibers as a consequence. That increases the failure probability of those nearby fibers, and that creates a tendency to develop clusters of fiber breaks. Those clusters create even larger stress concentrations, and you end up in a vicious cycle of ever-increasing stress concentrations and ever-increasing clusters of fiber breaks. Eventually, a critical cluster will develop, it will rapidly propagate unstably and lead to final failure. This is a pretty simple scheme. Pretty much all the models that exist to model this failure follow the same scheme, but there's a lot of details that matter a lot here. Today, I will talk a little bit about how we can do experimental validation. Then I will apply that to a benchmarking exercise that we ran where we compared six different models against experiments. And I will talk quite extensively about future directions where this field should head next. So starting with experimental validation, the first thing that you would normally do is to do a tensile test on a UD composite. That is what I would call macroscale validation. We've, in our lab, done this with six different strategies and compared the results and see what we get. So these are the six different designs. Two of them, the ones with the rectangular tab and the taper tabs, are the ones that are recommended by the standards. And they don't give us the highest values. So essentially, the standardized version leads to under-predictions or under-measurements of the values. They are actually 8% lower, and in addition, they have a 5 to 7% scatter, at least in this data, which means that if a model says that it's within 10% accuracy of the measurements, it's kind of doubtful. It's almost more a coincidence if you don't really have the required level of accuracy. So this, I think, shows that this is not the way to go to validate models. What you need to do is microscale validation. And to do that, there's essentially only one good way, I think, and that's using computed tomography at a synchrotron radiation source. If you're not familiar with synchrotron, essentially it's a big ring, a few hundred meters in diameter, that accelerates electrons. They then go through a bending magnet where a very bright beam of X-rays is created. That goes through a range of slits, sometimes a monochromator, into our loading rig, through our specimen, where the beam is attenuated. And that attenuated beam is cut onto the scintillator, converting X-rays into visible light, and then you can just use any camera, although typically use very expensive and very fast cameras for this. You already see the specimen highlighted in the middle of the rig. I want to talk about that in a little bit more detail. So the specimen is 4 millimeters wide, and typically we make this about 60 millimeters long. We've once made it shorter, and we had a lot of issues with what we call matchstick pullout. Essentially, the central zero-degree bundle is just being pulled out like a matchstick. So it needs to be 60 millimeters or longer to help preventing this splitting. We do have a notch, and this is a bit controversial. This is about 1 millimeter to 0.8 millimeter, and this helps to limit the failure load so our rig is strong enough to actually fail the specimen. And it's also important in order to limit the imaged volumes. I'll give you more details on that in a minute. We also use a cross-ply laminate typically. These 90-degree plies, they help to prevent the splitting and the matchstick pullout, and they also help to limit the manufacturing damage from water jet cutting. Now, when we publish using this specimen design, there's always at least one reviewer, if not all the reviewers, that comment, but you have stress concentrations, that's really an issue. Your results are not valid. I will try to show you that the results are valid and that this is actually a good design. So we did some finite element modeling, and you see here a cutout from that model focusing on the notched region, which is the one that we image. You have the zeros in the middle, 90s on the outside. Let me remove the thing that we are most interested in, the central 0 degree block. And now you can highlight what we are modeling in terms of damage mechanisms. So we have transverse cracks. We have delaminations between the zeros and the 90s, and we have splitting. These are the three mechanisms that we also observe experimentally. We can run our finite element calculation. Here we see the full model with the displacement field, but I want to focus on the stress field. And initially, those critical reviewers are correct. We do have severe stress concentrations, but this specimen only fails at about 800 to 900 newtons, so this is about 10% of the failure load. And when you run the model at higher loads, what you essentially see is the splits and the delaminations are growing, and they essentially delocalize the notch. And in the end, at 630 newton, you have an almost homogeneous stress field. And this is at about 70-80% of the failure load, which is the point at which you really start having fiber break and cluster development. So at the point where it matters, it's accurate. At the point where it doesn't matter, it's not a good approach, which is fine, I think. Another point about these experiments is repeatability. And these are two experiments on nominally identical specimens. I think you'll agree repeatability here is excellent. My argument here is that this is not just one specimen or two specimens. It's essentially 200 or 300 specimens, because that's the number of fiber breaks we have in these specimens. If you look at a more advanced feature, like the largest cluster size, which is dominated just by one occurrence, even there, you still see reasonably good repeatability, at least in terms of the overall trend. But there is, of course, going to be a bit more scatter here. I do have to add, this repeatability is only really good if you have continuous scanning, and there's only one beamline worldwide that can do it. And that's exactly the one that we tend to use. If you do hole that displacement scans, you don't have this level of repeatability. Now, synchrotron CT is an amazing technique, but it has its limitations, and I think it's also important to highlight those. There's obviously resolution trade-offs, and most of you, I think, will be aware that if you want a certain voxel size and you multiply that by the number of pixels in the detector, you get your field of view. And you ideally want your specimen to be fully within your field of view. There's actually recently a very interesting publication in that regard, where they had everything in the field of view in the red case, and they had 75% material sticking out in the blue case. And in the red case, you have really nice quality of this SMC material. In the region of interest scanning, the quality gets degraded a lot. So this is the reason why we need the notch, because we want our full specimen within the field of view to get the best possible image quality. Another important point is acquisition speed. We want to go as fast as possible, but we have to be aware that that lowers the quality. If we take one scan every 0.25 seconds, and I'm saying scan, not projection, scan, you get pretty poor quality and it's difficult to recognize fiber breaks. If you go faster and faster, you see better and better the fibers and segmentation will become a bit easier. If you go up to 10 seconds, the interface becomes quite crisp and then segmentation gets really straightforward. Faster also means that you can get closer to failure. If you do 10 seconds per volume, you can maybe get to 98% of the failure load. But if you go to 1 second or faster per volume, then you can get to 99.5 or 99.8 of the failure load. And since that's where the most interesting thing happens, we do try to push it to go as fast as possible. One side note on this, if you go to 1 second or faster per volume, you are creating approximately 0.5 terabyte to 1 terabyte of data just in 2 minutes. And that's a crazy amount of data to even transfer, let alone process. So that's also something you have to be mindful of when you're doing this type of experiments. The next limitation I want to talk about is the critical cluster. What you see here is the largest cluster that was ever found or ever reported, and it's a 14 plet. So it's 14 fiber breaks together. This, I have to add, is not a critical cluster. Many people have assumed that because of this, a critical cluster is about 14 fiber breaks. It is not. This is not critical because we can see it. A critical cluster is by definition unstable, and so if you can see it, it's not critical. So there is no experimental technique at the moment that can acquire images fast enough to actually spot this on the inside of a material. So let's leave the critical cluster terminology just for models, and when we talk about experiments, we should not even talk about a critical cluster. We just can't image it. So with that, I've highlighted the limitations and the benefits of synchrotron CT. Now we can move into benchmarking of the models against the experiments and the models against each other. First of all, why do we need benchmarking in the first place? Well, you have a long list of assumptions for any of these models, and some of them you'll see they overlap. Some of them are actually very different. What matters the most is, are the assumptions correct? And even more importantly, if they're wrong, maybe they're still acceptable. Maybe we know it's not correct, but it just speeds up the model, and that's maybe an acceptable trade-off to make. Having this benchmarking exercise allows us to establish the benefits, drawbacks, and limitations much better than you could do from just reading the individual papers, where it's typically very difficult to draw out these features. And probably most importantly is that it helps bring researchers together to have extremely high-level discussions to help propel this field forward and identify what future research should focus on. We had a first benchmarking exercise where we had 3 modeling partners and 1 experimental partner who provided the synchrotron data. That was the University of Southampton. At that time, we had a single specimen, a single material. We had hold-at displacement scans, so lack of repeatability, not continuously scanned. We did not analyze coplanarity because only 1 of the 3 models can actually do this. And we had to use input data from the literature and from data sheets instead of being able to measure it ourselves. All of this was already published in 2018. You have the full reference here. But today I want to focus on the second benchmarking exercise where we actually addressed these 4 points and did significantly better, I think. We also had 6 models instead of 3 models. I'm not going to talk about the details of any of these models. I will focus just on the main conclusions. If you want to read the instructions that were sent to the participants, you can read this on fibermodproject.eu, or you can also find all of this in the 3 papers that were published. The last one is a data in brief article, which also contains the last CT scan, all the input data, all the output data, all the model predictions. So if you now come with a 7th model, you can essentially just plug it into the Excel files and add your model to the comparison. I hope that sets a new golden standard for validation purposes. So we actually gathered all of our input data ourselves. So we did resin compression, resin tension, And from that, you can also derive the shear behavior. We did that for both of the resin systems that we used. For the two fibers that we used, we characterized about 100 single fiber tensile tests and provided all of that data as well. And that is enough for the modelers to start predicting. So this is the first result, failure strain predictions. There is two models that match quite well with the macro scale specimens, and four models that are, I would call it, severely over-predicting. Unfortunately, we cannot add the micro scale specimen here because we don't have a proper strain measurement there, but we can measure stresses. So if we look at the strength predictions, they are already a little bit closer together. The macro scale specimens are here, so now the two conservative models are actually under-predicting a little bit, and the over-prediction of the four other models has declined. The micro scale specimen actually matches really well with the macro scale specimen, so this is also positive validation of the approach of these micro scale specimens. Unfortunately, this is kind of expected. We know that these two models that are under-predicting here, that they are conservative. They apply very large stress concentration that we expected to be too large. So we actually don't really learn that much from this. What is wrong here? We can't tell just from this graph. For that, we need to look at the details, the fiber break evolution. What you see here in the dotted line is the Weibull prediction. This essentially is just the Weibull equation, no stress concentrations present, and you see that all the models are a bit over-predicting, which is because they do have stress concentrations in them. If we zoom in a little bit more, you actually see that I was lying. One of the models is actually under-predicting, and that's because they decided to cut off the lower tail of the Weibull distribution, which gets them in a way closer to the experiments, but with a completely wrong shape. So I think you can argue whether that's a good or a bad approach. But what you see here is that the Weibull distribution that we measured, despite doing more than 100 tests, is actually not accurate. We should be able to fit that almost perfectly, and we can actually impose that fit. So we can take one of the two experiments and simply fit our models to it, or our Weibull equation to it. And some of the models then re-render calculations, and then you get an almost perfect match. But now the magic is in what happens to the other parameters. This is just what we imposed. In terms of strength, the three models that were initially already over-predicting now over-predict even more. And HSL, you see that is now almost spot on because that prediction has also exceeded. Essentially, the fibers have gotten stronger, or our initial Weibull distribution was not strong enough. Now we have to look at more advanced cases again. Let's look at the average largest cluster size. You see that the two models, 3PFM and FISM, that they actually underpredict initially, but then they don't catch failure early enough, and then they go to way too large cluster sizes. Whereas HSL is almost spot on, more or less. But what you have to realize here is that HSL imposes coplanarity to the clusters, which is not imposed by the other two models that you see here. So that is a very important feature, I think, that I'm going to look at in a bit more detail now. In the first benchmarking exercise, and in earlier papers, we simply said a cluster is either coplanar or diffuse, but it's a very simple categorization. So here we did a little bit better. I have three fibers here, each of which have a fiber break. In the benchmarking exercise, we defined the region of influence as a cylindrical region based on finite element calculations. And in this case, you see that the three fiber breaks are within each other's zone of influence, which means they are a cluster of three fiber breaks. If we now measure the height like this, this is the triplet height. We can do that for all the triplets we have, and we can see how that evolves as a function of the applied stress. What you see here is initially it's zero because there are no triplets yet. When they do start developing, you see that the three over-predicting models in terms of strength also over-predict the cluster height compared to the experiments. What you also see is that HSL imposes coplanarity and is hence under-predicting the cluster height. So the truth lies somewhere in between the two extreme cases of these models. And that, I think, is a really important thing that we need to address in the future if we want to increase the accuracy. That brings me to future directions. where I want to highlight three cases. I've shown you that the Weibull strength distribution was essentially was not strong enough. And I think an important contributor to that is the effect of matrix on the fiber strength. We've hypothesized about this for almost 10 years. And what this means is most carbon fibers actually fail through surface flaws. And if there's matrix around it, that makes the severity of that surface flaw a little bit less, which means the fiber will get a little bit stronger. This is a hypothesis, but it's now also modeling from the people here, and I think the first poster after this keynote will actually go into detail about this, that actually confirms that the stress intensity factor goes down when you add matrix into this notched region. Another thing with the Weibull distribution is that we typically measure this at 5 to 40 millimeter, but we have to extrapolate it down to 7 micrometer, and that extrapolation is doubtful, and you need very accurate Weibull modulus in order to do this. To have that accurate Weibull modulus, you don't need to run just 100 tests, but I think you need to run several hundreds. We at Leuven just bought this automated single fiber tensile tester that allows us now to do 200-300 single fiber tensile tests a day in a very precise and controlled way. So I think that will help a lot. And if you have a researcher that wants to use this equipment, just get in touch with me and you can send them over for a research day to use this. The second thing that is important is dynamic stress concentrations. I show a simple example here just to highlight the importance. 7 parallel fibers, the middle one is broken, and we're going to look at the stress concentrations on the nearby fiber. I will plot this along the fiber length as a function of time, and this will happen in a microsecond. I have slowed it down a little bit for your purposes. So you see that it initially increases at the fiber break plane up to about 30%, and then when you go all the way to static equilibrium, which we do not show here, it drops back down to 20%. Now, all models would just use the static equilibrium values, but the dynamic ones are about 50% higher. If you implement this, and there's one model in the exercise that has done that, you actually see that this lowers the strength predictions. But unfortunately, it does nothing to the coplanarity issue. So it's part of the solution of improving the models, but not the core part of the solution. What I think is the core part is local stress concentrations. This is a recent example from 4 years ago, but actually this has been reported for about 30 years now, where if you do a double fiber fragmentation test, they tend to see a lot of coplanar breaks, much more than you would expect based on simple Weibull statistics. And these authors, they actually also calculated the fiber break model what the stress concentration should be in order to explain this, and they got stress concentration of around 100%. If you do finite element predictions on this, which I have not done, I would think you get something like 10, 20, 30% maybe, a lot lower than what's needed to explain this. What is the reason here is local stress concentrations. This is something we published 8 years ago, where you see that you have a stress concentration of 700% very locally. And that is, I think, the main reason why we're underestimating coplanarity. You see here, this is very local, so you get into issues with can you extrapolate strength down to that value. There's theoretical issues, but I think this is the most important thing to address. With that, I've covered future directions. I just want to conclude by making a few points that I think are important and are a bit more higher level. Combining experiments and models is very important, and you should combine it within the same researcher or in the same research group. If you look at the difference between the first and the second exercise, where it was separate versus together, we really, because we understand what the models need, we can do the experimental validation in a much better way, I think. Benchmarks and round robins are really important to address limitations and future directions. We are now also running a round robin to improve UD tensile tests to identify longitudinal tensile strengths. And the final point I want to make is related to the perspective with which we look at these models. So most people in this field, they actually look at it from a mechanics perspective. What they want to do is serve the end users, automotive, aerospace, and hence they need to be fast in predicting just the strength. They don't care about fiber break development and all the micro mechanisms as long as the strength is correct. This is not the only perspective. And I am kind of the odd duck a little bit in this field because I'm not a mechanics person, I'm a material scientist. And my point of view is that I want to also serve material suppliers and material developers. If you want to serve that community, you need to have all the micro-mechanisms right, and you want them to be able to say, if you change this to the matrix by 5%, what does that do to the longitudinal tensile strength? Whether that model runs in 5 seconds or in 5 hours, they will not care about that as much. So there are two perspectives, and I think they are equally valid, just the material science perspective is a bit undervalued in the field. I want to conclude by thanking the people that have worked on this in the last 10 years and all the benchmarking participants and you for your attention. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this very nice presentation. So now we have time for questions. About 5 minutes. So Fabrice, please.
Is there any micro?
Yeah. There's one coming.
Yes, thank you very much, Ansel. Very nice presentation. I really enjoyed it. I had a question about the geometry. What are the assumptions on the geometry behind all these models? Are you suppose all the fibers are well aligned, same diameters?
Yes, so all the models assume perfect alignment. There is essentially no model that I'm aware of that actually includes fiber misalignment. And we also have some data outside of the benchmarking exercise that shows that there is, for example, a tendency of individual fiber breaks to be more in fibers that are perfectly aligned and clusters to be more in regions with bigger misalignment. So that is also part of the things that might affect the predictions.
And how would you take that into account going forward? Because I guess it's probably a very important factor, but it's very obviously very hard to put in.
Yes, so I think in our own model, because we base our stress concentrations on finite element predictions, we actually can in principle do it, but the bookkeeping that we have to do is incredibly complex because it's not just the alignment of the broken fiber, it's the alignment of all the fibers around it, and the number of combinations is just infinite. So we have not tried this yet because I don't really see an easy way.
Statistical model? Statistical misalignment?
Yeah, you could at least study to some extent the effect of one simple type of misalignment, but studying the complete misalignment, that I think is outside the realm of possibilities at the moment.
Maybe you could also do some CT representation of real microstructures. That might be interesting, although challenging.
Wait, I don't understand what you mean.
To derive the actual fiber positions on your specimen using the tomography.
Oh, yeah, so that is what we have already done that, but then to represent that in a finite element model, that's almost impossible. We have done that to some extent, but then not plugged it into our fiber break model because that's where the rubber hits the road.
So my question really was about the models, so you didn't have time to tell us about the different models. Can you tell us a bit about what do you think the key features, the differences, the models, which make them better or worse?
I think in my opinion, the most important thing is how they manage stress concentrations and whether you impose coplanarity or not, and what the sort of the extent of the stress concentrations, over what length they are being applied. So some models don't assume that if a fiber break cluster is growing, that the ineffective length grows, which we know happens in reality. That's, I think, an important feature that's not that easy to model. But, for example, HSL puts all the stress concentration just on the nearby fiber, which means it's 100% stress concentration. That is quite a severe assumption that makes the model a lot faster, a lot easier. But that's obviously not accurate. I think stress concentration implementation is the short answer. People who are not co-chairs can also ask questions.
A
Chris.
Thank you, Jentel. If I remember well, most of the models are based on a stress criterion to predict the failure of fibers. But in the end, when you have a fiber break or a cluster of fiber breaks maybe connected through the matrix, you have a crack, a sharp crack. Do you think that using fracture mechanics, so a fracture mechanics approach to predict the propagation of the cluster and the failure of the fibers can help improving the predictions?
Yes, potentially, and there is actually one of the six models that does do this. So the HSL model by Pimenta and Pino, they actually have a fracture mechanics criterion to predict when it becomes unstable. I'm not sure how important it is because in the end, those two criterions, I would think they more or less coincide and they will find final failure more or less in the same point. That model has shown is that it does change size scaling predictions. I haven't shown this here, but we also did size scaling predictions in the benchmarking exercise, and a lot of the models actually struggle with this. They predict that the strength increases with increasing volume, which is obviously not correct. And if you do have that fracture mechanics criterion, that's one of the reasons why that HSL can actually predict this decreasing trend instead of the increasing trend.
Move to the next session, which is about failure mechanics.